Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And, Jim, we have good news, bad news, crazy news, as usual. We start with the good news, also as usual. And we go to the state of Michigan. If ever you thought that right to work would find a state that would be a mountain too hard to climb, you would think that it would probably be Michigan, given the strong union presence and certainly how the unions made out like gangbusters on the auto bailout and so forth. But that's not the case, necessarily. Last month, there was an initiative on the ballot that would have given labor a lot more powers, known as Proposal 2, which would have amended the state constitution to prevent limits on collective bargaining rights, including future right-to-work laws, defeated by 15 points. Now the Republican legislature looking to pass right-to-work legislation. Governor Rick Snyder's getting a little wobbly on it, but it looks like there's quite a bit of enthusiasm for this idea in Michigan. Indiana didn't shock me. I was thrilled to see it happen. But if it actually happens in my home state of Michigan, over the moon.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things where there are certain states you'd expect to see this, and Michigan is not one of them. When I was writing about Bobby Jindal down in Louisiana last year, I remember, you know, kind of this, one of the themes we were recognizing there was that it required the state to hit bottom before they were really willing to consider some, you know, conservative alternatives, that there'd kind of been this old boys network. And only the post-Katrina mess and chaos and the total failure of state government were they willing to talk to the fast-talking Indian-American guy who looks like he's about, you know, 30 years old. We may be seeing a similar phenomenon in Michigan, where as much as Rick Snyder, the governor, is doing his best up there, I was just reading elsewhere in the Wall Street Journal today that the abandoned lots within the city confines of Detroit are larger than the city of Paris in terms of acreage. You were talking about just a fiscal disaster area from top to bottom in so many parts of that state. And so all the old ways and this idea of, you know, there apparently was a slogan that, you know, strong unions mean a strong America. Look at Detroit. Well, now look at Detroit. And that may suggest why the public views have shifted rather strongly on that. Clearly, labor unions did not think they had a losing issue on this. And that referendum result really kind of jumps out at you as Obama was winning the state pretty handily. We were hoping that Romney was going to make a go of it. But this still remains a heavily Democratic state. But it's a heavily Democratic state that has apparently been growing a little skeptical of the arguments of unions. So you're seeing Republicans in the state legislature push this issue further. The labor unions are squealing, but I think that they clearly do not have the momentum with them on this. Was it Ben Franklin, something in the vein of, like, you know, nothing like the hangman's noose to concentrate the mind or something like that? Well, maybe there's nothing quite like utter fiscal collapse to get taxpayers and lawmakers to reexamine the assumptions of their economic policies and the idea that, gee, you know, maybe collective bargaining has turned into more of a hindrance to building economic growth than a partner in it. In fact, it maybe has become a dead weight to it, and the state simply cannot afford the culture of labor union dominance that it has enjoyed for really the past, you know, probably 60, 70 years.
Absolutely right. And as most people have noticed, while the United States as a whole, a lot of people have been paying attention to the fiscal mess on a national level for about 4 years now. In Michigan, it's been going on a whole lot longer. The main reason Rick Snyder got elected in a landslide in 2010, and the reason he's probably a little sketchy about wholeheartedly supporting this is because he knows there'd be a ton of labor money up against him in 2014 when he has to run for re-election. But he's stared down the unions before, so hopefully he does the right thing here again.
I would tell him, if you can handle that referendum in a year when Obama's on the ballot, he should be able to be okay in 2014. You know, buck up, Governor. You can handle it.
I think so. On to martini number two now, Jim. And we talked a bunch last week about what type of blame Republicans would get depending on what course of action they took in these fiscal cliff talks, whether to give Obama what he wants and let America really reap what they voted for, or if Republicans stick to their conservative guns and there's no deal and then who gets blamed. Well, turns out it doesn't really matter, unfortunately, according to a CBS poll. 53% are going to pretty much blame the Republicans if there's no deal. 27% will blame the president. That's a 2-to-1 margin, and doesn't look like the nitty-gritty details are going to make much of a difference here. I did see one other poll where Obama voters are split evenly on whether they think spending cuts or tax hikes are the way to resolve all this, but overall it doesn't look like the numbers are in our favor yet again.
Mary Catherine Hamm over at Hot Air did a pretty good way of summarizing all this, saying that we're not just a divided country. We're a schizophrenic country because some, you know, Here we have an election in which, much to our great frustration, Obama has been reelected. And I don't think there was any illusions about how President Obama deals with these issues, which is to say that generally he doesn't. And when he does, he prefers to do so entirely through tax increases and maybe token cuts outside of defense. Well, you know, there's a poll done by this think tank Third Way, and it says 96% of Americans believe the federal deficit is a problem, which is good. I don't think we're necessarily behaving this way, but at least you can get, you know, broad consensus on that. Of Obama voters, it splits 41% to 41% about do you prefer it mostly by cutting spending or mostly through tax increases. And only 5% of Obama supporters want tax increases alone. So, you know, here we have a case in which Obama voters are more conservative than the president himself and his negotiating stance for, so far. A CNN poll found that registered voters oppose Obamacare 52% to 42%. And independents oppose it even more strongly, 57% to 35%. And look at these voters and I think, man, you know, Greg, this is great news. Romney's got a great shot at beating Obama. Oh, wait, we had the election last month. Oh, okay. You're banging your head against the wall, wondering if all these people, what they're telling the pollsters, they recognize they just voted precisely the opposite less than a month ago. It is baffling and frustrating and all that stuff. It may strengthen Republicans a little bit. Now, the whole idea that the public is going to blame Republicans, that kind of has become almost this Pavlovian knee-jerk response of people. They're used to hearing the media and Obama insist that this is all Republicans' fault. And so, a slim majority of voters are going to say this is all Republicans' fault. In a way, I don't think the Democrats and their allies in the media, although perhaps I repeat myself, recognize how much this affects Republican negotiating tactics, because if Republicans are going to get blamed either way, well, then they might as well stick by their principles. This whole idea of Republicans will get the blame no matter what really doesn't puts them in a circumstance where they really don't have that much to lose. So I don't think this is necessarily going to drive Republicans to be more conciliatory. I think they're going to say, you know what, we're going to get blamed either way. Let's go, we might as well stick to our guns and hold to our positions. And if we end up going over the cliff and sequestration takes effect, fine, we'll get some of the blame. But let's remind America that Obama said in that third debate, sequestration will not happen. And, it appears by January 1st, expiration date will be achieved.
That actually went a little longer than some of his promises, unfortunately. But yeah. The expectation of him keeping them is about the same as it was the first 4 years. On to martini number three now. And yesterday we talked about Bob Costas and his, at the very least, ill-timed political commentary on gun control during the halftime of the Sunday night game in the wake of the Javon Belcher murdering his girlfriend, Cassandra Perkins, and then turning the gun on himself in front of his coaching staff at Arrowhead Stadium in Kansas City. That was an ill-timed thing. And, of course, some of the flaws of the gun control argument in the wake of something like this. Jim, in the Jolt today, you have taken it a step further in how every time something like this happens, it's not necessarily one particular issue that pops up, although several of them usually do, but it's this: we as a society need to take a long, hard look at ourselves in the mirror and figure out what we've all done wrong to let something like this happen. And, well, we looked at ourselves in the mirror to shave this morning, Jim, but as it comes to our role in this particular murder-suicide, not so much.
Well, we looked in that mirror. You know what we saw today, Greg? Stubble. That's all we saw, okay? And then we took care of that because we're clean-shaven guys. No, I'm kind of baffled by this. Basically, it happens almost after every shooting, although it kind of comes after every time something terrible happens. The sense of, we all have to look at ourselves. No, bull, horse pucky, I'm going to say, and you all know the words that I wanted to say there, but this is a family podcast. But comments like this that are always make me, put me in danger of not making this a family podcast because it's outrageous and ridiculous. Perhaps most infuriating was this column by Kevin Powell, former Democratic congressional candidate in New York. And for those, with long memories, a cast member of the original season of The Real World. And he writes this whole column about how the culture of manhood and machismo and all this stuff is what causes, this violence. We all need to look at ourselves and. The sentence that just drove me crazy was, "The lives of Jovan Belcher and Cassandra Perkins will have been in vain completely if we do not go deeper within ourselves to teach and show our sons, our husbands, our boyfriends, our fathers, and men and boys that there's another way." Well, we're all doing that, Kevin. none of us have gone off on shooting sprees. The only people who did this is Jovan Belcher. And when you talk about his, has his life been in vain? Well, gee, he According to the New York Post this morning, he was out, you know, with another woman the night before, sleeping in his Bentley. He had a $1.7 million contract. Juwan Belcher was not a man in destitute, in dire straits. Now, there are a lot of people who are wondering, was this, you know, concussion and you know, head-related injuries that may have affected this? He may have struggled with mental illness or depression or a whole bunch of other things. But in case, the bottom line is, you know, the person who's responsible for what Juwan Belcher did is Juwan Belcher, not you, not me, not society at large. And I was looking at this and saying, why on earth are we listening to some former Real World cast member lecture us about how we need to be better as a society? By the way, no offense meant to Congressman Sean Duffy of Wisconsin, a former member of the Real World. We do have a couple of good ones in there. Why on earth is this guy talking to us? And then I remembered, and I went back and I checked it, look it up. On that infamous first season of The Real World, it turns out Kevin Powell had attacked one of his fellow cast members and had a violent temper and stuff like that. So he now talks about domestic violence as a reformed practicer of domestic violence. I'm glad Kevin Powell is getting his life together. But I do kind of look at that and wonder, I wonder if there's some projection going on here. Because really, the problem with this circumstance is not society. It is not men at large. It's not that we all have to look deeper within ourselves. You know how we do need to look deep within ourselves, Greg? We need to look deep in ourselves and look at one, something terrible happens, such as an NFL player killing his girlfriend, and the mother of his child, and himself. Why do we look out at the rest of society to find somebody to blame? Why are we incapable of having a culture of individual responsibility and saying, hey, the guy who shot his girlfriend is responsible? Why do we need to get like Bob Costas, get up on a soapbox and turn this into a moral crusade to pass a particular piece of legislation as if any bill could take tragedy away from our lives? Anyway, so that's me getting down off my soapbox. As I said, there are certain days where you just can't seem to find much to you know, really get the blood flowing and the passions rolling. But this morning was not one of those mornings, Greg.
Yeah, absolutely not. And, you know, this happens, unfortunately, frequently enough that these conversations circle back around and we have to keep fending off these insane overreactions from all these different angles. And so eventually it bubbles up and boils over the surface. And I say, amen, sir. Well said indeed. So go ahead and relax now. Take a couple deep breaths and we'll talk to you tomorrow.
I'm going to take some depressants right now. I'm you know, the blood pressure medication will be kicking in right any second now.
There you go. Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks so much for being with us today. And don't forget to join us again tomorrow for the Wednesday edition of the 3 Martini Lunch.